It's 5 o'clock and one more working day is finally at an end. I hurry from my job and start the car, fight the traffic once again. Driving down the interstate, my tension eases as the traffic thins. And I leave my worries far behind and wonder what the in crowd might be doing. Farther down the road, a pretty woman's waiting with a drink for me. There's a lot of woman there, and pretty soon that's where I'm gonna be. I'm the only one that's missing. I'm the one the in crowd's waiting for. And I drive around the back and leave the car. Then I open up the door. And there stands the in crowd. They're not the sin crowd. They're the light of my life crowd. My kids and my wife crowd. She had me my coffee. And the kids gather around me. And it makes me so proud.
And that's John Conley. He sings a lot of working man songs. And that's our song for Freya's Day here in the bunker. Ladies' Day. Ladies' Day in the bunker. Well, let's see what the date is here. Look at the Frank Silva Memorial clock on the wall. Oh, July 1st, 2016. Now you got 30 days or so to get her done. So you get... But you better not forget and slow down. Think about it, because 30 days passes pretty quick. Well, there'll be a lot of activity this weekend at Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station. Probably be a lot of people in here picking up their weapons of mass destruction from our world-renowned mass destruction equipment yard. Yeah, the big stuff. Not any small stuff. Big stuff. Big motorized vehicles and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, they'll probably drink a few beers over there. I might sing a little karaoke. But I don't get too excited on these holidays anymore once you know what's behind all these stories and all these wars and all this crap. And the fact that they celebrate the war and they don't memorialize the millions of white people who died for these wars. They want to talk about everything else, you know, lighting firecrackers and going downtown and buying a new car, stuff like that. But they don't really get it because I think it was today started the Battle of the Marne in First World War where over a million white men died. And, of course, there also I heard of a new book that's out on the Coal Canyon. I think it's called the Coal Canyon Battle of Coal Canyon. I think that's it, in the Civil War. They don't talk about that much. Grant never talked about it because they lost 7,000 men in a couple of hours. Yeah. That's the kind of butchery that goes on when you're protecting capital. Yes, you heard me, when you're protecting capital, because those slaves were simply capital items, like a tractor or hay rake or something like that. And so, what was it? At least 250,000, mostly white men died in that Civil War. You're going to be hearing all this war nostalgia all weekend, and I hate it, because they do not quite see it the way it should be looked at, you know. Terrible things happened to our race. Millions of our people died, which makes us the worst enemy of ourselves. No, I mean, you can't blame the Jews for all of that. You can't blame the blacks for all of that. You can't blame the Asians for all of that. But you can sure blame a hell of a lot of white people for most of that, waging war against itself. And now we're paying for it with the lack of population. And still, they allow invasions of more non-white people into the country and encourage the black birth rate and so forth like that. None of them talk about, they don't say white men that died in these wars. They don't say white men who died in these battles. They don't say anything about white men. They say the American people or Western civilization. They don't say white Western civilization, which it primarily was. They leave that out, you know. White is the forgotten word. I heard one of these right-wingers on this morning talking about the Battle of New Orleans and how Andrew Jackson won the War of 1812. No, he didn't. He was quite involved in the War of 1812, but the Battle of New Orleans, the war was over weeks before that battle was even fought. So all the guys on both sides that died in the Battle of New Orleans died for nothing. But still, we make heroes out of everybody and forget to talk about all the casualties on both sides. These are the thoughts that the general so-called right-wing patriotic movement won't own up to. They won't do it. And that's because they want to do it again. Yeah, you got it. They want to do it again. They like war. They worship war. And the leaders are psychopaths, absolute psychopaths. I was listening to a lecture on psychopaths the other night. You can't cure a psychopath. They're born that way. There's only one way you can cure a psychopath, and that's put them out of their misery. Because they're never going to change, and you're never going to change them. Many things and many problems people have you can change, but not a psychopath. And unfortunately, most of our leaders are psychopaths. They're obviously psychopaths by the way they act. This new book is out on, I didn't write it down, about the Clintons in the White House by this Secret Service guy. I think he's black. I haven't seen his picture, but he sounds black. Boy, he's taking a lot of shit because he exposed all the crap that the White House turned into a whorehouse. I was just hearing today where at one point there Clinton was getting on a plane to go someplace when he was president, and they were talking about this expensive haircut he got. Well, it turns out that Hillary had hit him with a great big glass ashtray and cut his head. So they had to do quite a bit of finagling to cover up that cut on his head before he took off. As far as I'm concerned, it's too bad she didn't kill the son of a bitch. Or too bad they didn't draw down on each other in the White House. That would have been great. But tremendous numbers of white people out there don't understand what a psychopath is. And so they continually fall into the psychopath's lair and fall victim of psychopaths. And until you understand what a psychopath is and how dangerous they are and how criminal they are, prone to criminal activity, and the fact that they can't be cured except by stopping their heart, then you'd get someplace. If you knew that, if people out there would all know that. And look at that. You see now where they're saying that Donald Trump was running around with this Jew. And I think there's adequate evidence that he did. This Jew was his buddy. And they were into all kinds of sexual activity, which, as far as regular sexual activity, so what? I may not agree with them, but in this case, it's little girls or young girls. They wanted these teenage girls or maybe even preteen. And Bill Clinton was in on it, too. You know, they flying over to some island and having all those sex parties with preteen girls. And I believe it. I believe they're all a bunch of bastards. They're all beyond redemption. And I hate to see it when our people get all wrapped up in supporting any of these guys. I think it's more important to stand back and hope they destroy each other. Well, I dug up something here. I'm not sure how accurate it is. I don't know. But it's interesting. Looks interesting. Leopold Weiss, the Jew who helped invent the modern Islamic state. I'm going to read this to you. I don't know how accurate it is, but in 1961, the eminent Muslim scholar Muhammad Asad, then living in Europe, published The Principles of State and Government in Islam. The central question posed in the book is whether Islam is opposed to mixing of religion and politics as in the modern West. See, they don't say white West, they just say the West. Though Assad's answers to this question are subtle and not categorical, his overall conclusion is that in a majority Muslim states, a mixture of politics and religion is necessary. Well, how else could a psychopath operate? Society must bind itself to the will of God, Assad stated. And the organization of an Islamic state or states is an indispensable condition of Islamic life in the true sense of the word. In other words, you need Jewish politics within your Islamic state. It's bad enough to have an Islamic state and worship unconditionally the nonsense they worship. This was not the first time that Assad, who had been publishing books and articles since the mid-30s, called for the infusion of religion into politics. That's a real dangerous combination. In his highly influential 1934 essay, Islam at the Crossroads, Assad articulated a set of principles about the relationship between the Muslim world and the West, the White West, that served as a basis of his later conversions with Muslim Iqbal and other Islamic activists. He envisioned in Pakistan and elsewhere the emergence of Muslim states thoroughly modern but inspired and informed by religious principles. Yada, yada, yada. Assad's vision of Islamic state bears little resemblance to the militant anti-white Western version propagated by ISIS today. He conceived of an Islamic state based on modern interpretations of the Quran and the Islamic legal traditions, a state grounded in democratic principles where women would be treated as equals and civil rights of non-Muslims respected. Perhaps that's not surprising given Assad's roots. He was born at the turn of the 20th century in Austria-Hungary, in what is now the Ukraine, as Leopold Weiss. His grandparents were Orthodox Jews. His paternal grandfather was a rabbi. Weiss' parents were secularized and assimilated to European culture, white culture. His father was a successful lawyer in Vienna. As a child, Weiss had a basic Jewish education and working knowledge of Hebrew. Educated at German universities, you see the way we gave away all our information and education to people we shouldn't have given to? And imbued with liberal values, he lived in the bohemian quarters of the Weimar Republic at the height of its cultural awakening and became a journalist covering the Middle East after the fall of the Ottoman Empire. He lived in the bohemian quarters of the decadent Weimar Republic. A visit to relatives in Jerusalem and a subsequent long sojourn in Arabia caused him to fall in love with the Arabs, unquote. That's pretty hard to do, fall in love with all the Arabs. Increasingly disillusioned with the West, white West, and rejecting the Marxism adopted by many of his European contemporaries as purely materialist, Weiss converted to Islam in 1926. He expressed his new identity with the name Muhammad Assad. Assad, meaning lion, was the equivalent of both his Hebrew name, Ayah, and his Latin-derived name, Leopold. So here's where the Jew infiltrates the Islamic situation. I first learned of Assad in 1978 when I spent a term at the University of Tunis as a graduate student in Arabic language and Islamic culture. I had been searching for an accessible English translation of the Quran when one of my teachers mentioned the message of the Quran, the long-awaited interpretation by renowned scholar Muhammad Assad, would soon be published. You see, now here's the Jew interpreting the information in the Quran. That's not a good thing. Turning to me, the only person in the class with a recognizable Jewish name, my Tunisian professor noted that the translator was a Jew who had converted to Islam and become one of the great authorities on Islamic holy book. See how the Jews got to get into everything? Christianity, the Muslim, everything. Intrigued by his unlikely story, I researched Assad's life and discovered that in the past 13 years he'd been living in Tangiers. Through an American friend living in Tangiers, I sent Assad a note requesting an interview. Assad didn't respond to me directly, but he told our mutual acquaintance, Shalom Goldman, sounds like a rabbi, tell Goldman I have no intention of returning to Judaism. Well, I had no intention of bringing Assad back to Judaism, but could find no way to convince him of that. In 1978, over half a century after his 1926 conversion, he remained wary of Jewish interlocutors who might challenge him on religious grounds, especially if he suspected those interlocutors had ties to Israel. Yet he never lost completely his connections to Europe and his family. He tried unsuccessfully to help his parents and sister escape the National Socialists and to remain in touch with relatives who immigrated to Palestine in 1939, even as Assad became one of the chief architects of the modern political Islam and leading antagonist of the Jewish state. Very interesting. I don't know whether I'm going to go ahead and read the rest of this or not. It goes on and on, but the point is that how Jews infiltrate everything, whether they created it or not, and usually they didn't create it, but they infiltrate it and use it. Well, maybe I'll read on a little farther. Assad began his travels in Egypt and then went to Palestine, where he visited relatives who had extended an invitation. These relatives were two maternal uncles, both of whom were prominent physicians. One was a psychoanalyst. Yeah, that figures. The first to practice the profession in Palestine. The other was an ophthalmologist. Through them, Weiss met and interviewed the Zionist leadership at the time. To these leaders, Chaim Weizmann and Arthur Rupin among them, Weiss posed sharp and critical questions about Zionist intentions concerning the Arabs of Palestine. Some years later, he wrote that I conceived from the outset a strong objection to Zionism. I considered it immoral that immigrants assisted by a foreign great power should come from abroad and with the avowed intention of attaining to a majority in the country and thus dispossessing the people whose country it has been since time immemorial. Weiss visited kibbutz and urban communities, but it seems that nothing in Zionist activity appealed to him. Quite the contrary. Zionism and its followers repelled him, and his articles to that effect in the German and Austrian press further distanced himself from his Jewish co-religionists in general and from his family in particular. In the Jerusalem, Weiss found an anti-Zionist ally in Jacob Israel Dehan, the journalist and activist who was the bane of the Zionist movement. Only a few months after his meeting with Weiss and other vocal, influential opponents of the new Yeshuv, Dehan was assassinated in the first political murder within the Jewish community in Palestine. Assad's conversion to Islam in 26 was linked to his rejection of Zionism. He saw Zionism as tribal and linked to colonialism. In his later writings, Zionism is depicted as an aspect of the chosen people concept, a concept Assad often mentions with derision in his Quran commentary. For Assad, Islam is universalist and Judaism is particularist. Soon after his conversion, Assad went on to Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca. It was accomplished by his European wife Elsa and her son by her first marriage. In Saudi Arabia, Assad, using his journalistic connections and skills and prestige, he accrued a European convert to Islam, became a confidant of King Abdulaziz. During his 6 years in the kingdom, Assad served as an advisor to the Saudi royal court. So there you got a converted Jew to Islam as an advisor to the Saudi royal court. But that relationship turned sour when Assad criticized corrupt Saudi officials and suggested that the government adopt more pious and less extravagant modes of behavior. As to the connection between Wahhabi teachings and the Saudi royalty, Assad made this observation, one that embodies his critical approach to religion and government. The history of the Wahhabis is the history of a religious idea which rose on the wings of enthusiasm and longing and then sank down into the lowlands of Pharisaic self-righteousness, for all virtue destroys itself as soon as it ceases to be longing and humility. After 6 years in Saudi Arabia, Assad traveled to India, where in 32 he met the philosopher and poet Muhammad Iqbal. He lived from 1877 to 1938, who encouraged the young convert to stay and help to elucidate to the intellectual premises of the future of the Islamic State, and in tandem with this to serve as scholarly bridge between the South Asian Islam and the English-speaking West. It was India, in Iqbal's urging, that Assad wrote Islam at the Crossroads. The 1934 essay addressed to fellow Muslims, in that essay, Assad described his journey to Islam. He made no mention of his Jewish background or of his radical rejection of Zionism. He told his readers almost nothing about his own past other than that he, unlike his readers, had had to discover Islam. And since his conversion, he had endeavored, he wrote, to learn as much as he could about Islam. I studied the Quran and the traditions of the Prophet. I studied the language of Islam and its history. And a good deal of what has been written about and against it. I spent over 5 years in Arabia, mostly in Medina, so that I might experience something of the original surroundings in which this religion was preached by the Arabian prophet. These studies and comparisons created in me the firm conviction that Islam as a spiritual and social phenomenon is still, in spite of the drawbacks caused by the deficiencies of the Muslims, by far the greatest driving force mankind has ever experienced. And all my interest became, since then, centered around the problem of its regeneration. And I'll end up there. Interesting. Hilaire Belloc years ago wrote a book called A Bucket of Eels, A Basket of Eels. where you reach in, you couldn't catch on to the tail you wanted to catch on to. You're so confused. That's religion. Religion's a bucket of eels, and it gets complicated, complicated, complicated. Distortions built upon distortions, fabrications built on fabrications, lies built on lies, under cover of wanting to help mankind, usually. It's amazing how it never seems to turn out to really help mankind. Whether that's because the bad psychopaths take a hold of it and use it, can't say, maybe a little bit of both. But I know what Christ's insanity has done to the white race in the Western world. Even in the colonies, it was they separated from each other. You know, you had the Maryland, you had the Catholics, and Pennsylvania, you had the Protestants, and New York, you had a little bit of both, and the Jews, and so forth. So they didn't like each other. In fact, that's why they left Europe. Then they came over here and drug the whole damn thing over here and continued to fight. Let's get into a little bit of pessimist guide to history again here. 1879, let's go back there. Bridge collapse. Extending for some 2 miles across Scotland's Tay River estuary, the Tay Bridge had been hailed as an engineering marvel because of its great length. Though work had begun in 1871, the bridge was not open until 1878 because of various problems, including construction accidents that killed nearly 20 workmen. Nevertheless, when Queen Victoria traveled across the bridge in 1878, she was so impressed by its beauty and size that she knighted construction engineer Thomas Bouch for his design. The afternoon of December 28, 1879, some 18 months after the Tay Bridge opened, turned dark and stormy. By evening, heavy rains fell, and gale-force winds gusted to 75 miles per hour, churning the waters of the Tay estuary. Although it was Sunday, the Sabbath, one train had been allowed to make the round trip from Dundee to Burntisland in Scotland by way of the Tay Bridge. Finally, just about 7 p.m., the 7-car train approached the Tay Bridge on its return leg to Dundee. 80 people, including passengers and the train crew, were aboard. Visibility poor because of the rain, but a railway signalman watched the train creep across the bridge at 3 miles per hour, with only its red taillights piercing the darkness. Just as the lights disappeared between the upper girders and the center span, there was a fearful blast with flashes of light. When the train lights did not reappear, the alarmed signalman tried to telegraph Dundee, but the line was dead. Meanwhile, on the Dundee side of the bridge, railway workers became worried some minutes later when the train failed to appear. With telegraph lines dead, there was no choice but to send someone to find out what had happened. Battered by howling winds and rain, a locomotive foreman bravely crawled onto the exposed single-track bridge on his hands and knees. Inching his way into the stormy darkness, he ventured far out onto the bridge before halting abruptly. Suddenly, there was nothing ahead of him except rails, dangling down toward the water 90 feet below. The bridge was gone. Perhaps the combined stress of the gale-force wind and the weight of the train caused the center span to collapse. Or possibly the span had already begun to give way in the high winds. Whatever happened that fateful evening, the whole 7-car train, tons of twisted iron girders, crashed downward some 90 feet into the dark, storm-tossed Tay estuary. All 80 people, including women and children, passengers, and the entire train crew, were killed. Passengers inside the train never had a chance. Those who might have survived the terrible fall were drowned as the train sank beneath the waves in waters 45 feet deep. Even if the victims had time to try to save themselves before passenger cars sank, their efforts would have been in vain. In accordance with the rules on the British railroads, doors on passenger cars were locked. Following the disaster, a court of inquiry investigation determined the bridge designer, Thomas Bouch, had failed to consider the effect of strong winds on the structure. Further, materials used in the construction were found to be of poor quality. These mistakes were not repeated in the construction of the second Tay Bridge in 1887, which still remains in use today. Thomas must have slept through the physics class. Well, I guess that just shows that queens and monarchs can be wrong. She knights the guy and then he has a great disaster. 1881. This is an exciting one. Assassination of Tsar Alexander II. Two members of the radical populist movement, get that, populist, that's what they're calling what's going on today, populism. Radical populist movement called Land and Liberty ambushed the Russian Tsar Alexander II as he returned by carriage from a parade in St. Petersburg on March 13th. The assassins stood on either side of the street armed with glass bombs filled with nitroglycerin. Wow! As the Tsar passed, one assassin hurled his bomb beneath the carriage. It blasted off the back of the vehicle, but left the Tsar unharmed. As the shaken Tsar left the carriage, the second assassin hurled his bomb directly at the Tsar's feet. The explosion mangled one of the Tsar's legs and tore out one of his eyes. He died less than 2 hours later. The assassination led to the period of severe repression under Tsar Nicholas III. We now call these bombs Molotov cocktails. There you go. I think somebody's mistaken here because Molotov cocktails normally are filled with gasoline and a simple crude wick out the top, not nitroglycerin. A nitroglycerin bomb would be extremely difficult to transport to wherever you're going to throw it at somebody. And the slightest misuse or nudging of the thing will explode in your hands. But they would be extremely effective, nitroglycerin bombs. And I haven't heard of any Islamics or anybody like that or anybody else using a nitroglycerin bomb. That's an interesting concept. Well, I'm going to run by another little article called Jewish Decline and the Rise of China in the U.S. And we'll see what you think of this. This was contributed by one of our subscribers, and Ethel will be reading.
Jewish Decline and the Rise of China in the United States. Decline and the Rise of China in the United States. Posted on June 28, 2016 by Fred Reed. Years ago, when I was tech writer for weird magazines such as Signal and for other more normal tech-ish pubs, Jews littered the intellectual landscape. They were all over high-end research, such as Bell Labs. The big names were often Jewish: Einstein, von Neumann, Feynman, Gell-Mann, Minsky. The staff list for the Manhattan Project read like a yeshiva yearbook. The same happened in the arts. Bernstein, Landowska, Rubinstein, Stoppard, Maidens in Search of Godhead, and vice versa. Jews were smart, most people figured, not necessarily liking it. I wondered why without great interest. Genetic determinists of course cooked up evolutionary explanations involving undiscovered genes acted upon by unquantifiable selective pressures to produce assumed results not correlatable with the pressures. Business as usual. Later I began to notice without thinking about it that the Jewish names were growing thin on the ground. These were not systematic observations. But Asian names were becoming prominent almost everywhere. The Feinsteins seemed to be in recession, if only anecdotally. Something odd was happening, I barely noticed. Then Ron Unz published The Myth of American Meritocracy, documenting a stunning turnaround of which I had been only vaguely aware. The book deals substantially with corruption in admissions to Ivy schools, with some, I think, good ideas for reform.
It also charts the sharp decline in Jewish achievement and the meteoric rise of the Asians. Actually, I think falling is more what meteors do, but clichés are clichés. As one example, consider the NMSQT, the National Merit Scholastic Qualifying Test, given nationally to high schoolers. To be a semi-finalist, a student has to test in the top one-half of 1% sort of upper-middle brow intelligence. In 2010 there were about 2,000 semi-finalists in California, the state with the second highest Jewish population after New York. Citing an analysis of last names, Unz notes that there was only one Cohen, Levy, and Kaplan, but 49 Wongs and 36 Kims. This pattern, Unz notes with lots of documentation, repeats across the country. For example, in the ultra-high-end high schools such as Thomas Jefferson in Virginia and Stuyvesant in New York. These places are scary smart, Caltech in short pants. Unz. Jews and Asians today are about equal in number within New York City, but whereas a generation ago elite local public schools such as Stuyvesant were very heavily Jewish, today Jews are outnumbered at least several times over by Asians. In 2012, Asians were 72.5% of Stuyvesant students, with all whites at just 24%, of whom an unspecified fraction were Jewish. Which is to say that even if all the whites were Jews and no Hagvakas, house and garden variety, non-Jewish, Caucasians, the Asians would be outperforming the Jews by 3-1. Which is crazy strange. Now the reader may say, but Fred, this objection and that objection, and what about? Fair enough, but in condensing a book into three paragraphs one leaves things out. The sources are there and the analysis careful. And no, the book is not an attack on Jews, Unz himself being Jewish and a Harvard grad. Methinks, subject to correction, that his findings shed considerable darkness on what we think we know about intelligence. Jews still perform better than Hagvakas, but less better than before, and the Asians are way ahead of the Jews. It seems unlikely that the Asians have suddenly risen in biological intelligence, or that Jews have gone down. Putting it otherwise, when one group falls almost overnight on a wide variety of tests thought to measure intelligence, and another rises, it follows that either intelligence can change very fast or the tests are not measuring intelligence. So what is happening? What do the aptitude tests measure? The easy explanation is that the Chinese kids are of about normal intelligence but just work harder. Yet when a kid gets into Stuyvesant or MIT, he can't get by on hard work and modest aptitude any more than I could play for the Chicago Bulls by practicing hard. You have to be smart to do, say, computational fluid dynamics. Actually really, really smart with tensors and things. Which is why I have trouble buying the explanation offered by a Jewish friend, we've lost our hunger. I think he means that in his day there were Jewish quotas in universities and no room in the country club, so when those barriers lifted the Jewish kids were going to show the goyim what was what and went at everything fang and claw and, well, showed the goyim. Then they got comfortable, moved to the suburbs, and maybe even watched football. I have known people with very high pre-dumbing down sats, and merit semi-finalists, and people with IQs in excess of 150. They didn't just know stuff. They were bright. Was intrinsic intelligence raised in the Asian young by hard study? Whatever is happening, it is grave. Consider Caltech, which probably has the highest standards for admission in the country. Further, it does not practice affirmative action. The demographics of the stud entry, black, 2%, Hispanic, 12%, white, including Jewish, 28%, Asian, 44%. This is worse than it seems at a glance because Asians are only 15% of the population of California and 6% of the national. Whatever is happening, it is not a statistical fluke. A couple of quotes from the book among many similar ones. For example, among math Olympiad winners, white Gentiles scarcely outnumbered Jews during the 1970s, but since 2000 have become over 15 times as numerous. Over 40% of Putnam winners prior to 1950 were Jewish, but since 2000 the percentage has dropped to under 10%, without a single likely Jewish name in the last 7 years. The Putnam is a very high-end math test. Another of my friends has an Asian wife and thus entree into the Asian community. He quotes there, wisely private, outlook, whites are lazy and stupid. If you like succinct, you just got it. The curious thing is that the Asians are not just way ahead of Jews, but way ahead of Hag Vacus. The gap is huge, and seems to me too large to be explained by the few points of extra IQ sometimes attributed to East Asians. The Asian rise may have consequences. It is not thought proper to notice that the white population of America, numbering very roughly 200 million, provides nearly all of the scientific advance, engineering, and entrepreneurship. China has, again very roughly, a billion Han Chinese, you know, the kind that dominate Hag Vacus and Jews in the United States. I watch Chinese technology as best I can. In 15 years, China has gone from having no supercomputers to having slightly more than the United States has, including the world's two fastest, the most rapid of which, Taihui Light, is a Chinese design using Chinese semiconductors. Obama, ever brilliant, stopped Intel from selling them chips, so they apparently decided they needed to supply their own. The quantum crypto line from Beijing to Shanghai, said to have been spurred by a desire to keep NSA off China's back, is noticeably more advanced than carrier pigeons. The Type 093B Nuki attack sub just launched seems a major improvement over its predecessor. The 300 miles per hour plus Shanghai Maglev trains uses foreign technology, but now they know how to do it. China is by far the world leader in high-speed rail, of which America has none. Beijing is trying hard to advance technologically and with success with Jews going dark, and Hag Vacus worried about safe spaces and microaggressions. Who is going to protect America against competition by potentially five times as many engineers as we have, especially if they perform as well as our Asians do?
And you were concerned about the wetbacks. We got a chink-chink Chinaman situation. I remember several years ago, roaming around San Francisco, I had to go up there to do a TV show. And I went into bookshops, the bookstores, and the place was crammed with Asians. Almost all Asians in the bookstore. And what were they doing? They were speed reading every book in the place. Speed reading. All the technical books, they were speed reading. And obviously taking that information back to China. So we've given away everything. The white race gives everything away. I mean, so I don't know whether you can make excuses for the white race or not. I can't. Well, I'm going to run a little thing here for you that I've been talking about for quite some time. In fact, several years about the Zionist National Socialist Connection and Hitler's association with the Zionists. And most of the time, the right wing is say, oh, you're crazy, you don't know what you're talking about. Well, this got a little lecture from Eustace Mullins, who I never really met Eustace Mullins. I knew all about him and listened to a lot of his stuff, and he was a sharp guy. He's passed away now. But at the beginning of this recording, which I had to record in front of a TV, it's not really good quality, but when he speaks, I think you'll be able to understand and get the idea of how the whole bullshit, 6 million and all that, is just a scam and a sham. Of course, I've told you how I theorize that the Zionists were very upset with the Jews in Germany that had assimilated so greatly. and were doing fine until they got all this crap started. And I believe that the Zionists wanted to punish these assimilated Germans, Jews, and Hitler wanted to get them out of Germany, which his approach to that was sort of knee-jerk for sure.
The Nazis and the Zionists in 1933, which allowed German Jews and their assets to go to Palestine. Rich Samuels joins us tonight with the story of the controversy behind the book and the author's struggle to write it. Rich?
Deborah, with the rise of Adolf Hitler to power in the spring of 1933, the Jews of the world were faced with a dilemma. They could raise a cry of protest, a cry few would heed, or they could make a deal with Hitler, a deal that would bring a step closer to their dream of an independent Jewish state.
American Jews marched calling for the boycott of all German exports. Jews throughout Europe echoed that call, so did Jews everywhere. But a group of Zionists at the same time was quietly negotiating an agreement with the Nazis to allow the immigration of German Jews and the transfer of their assets to Palestine. That deal, reported in August 1933, was the transfer agreement. Palestine, sparsely settled by Jews at the time, was radically changed as a result.
I lived in Palestine from 1933 to 1936, and we saw every week transports of German Jews coming to settle in Palestine.
German-Jewish settlement of Palestine was, for a time, official Nazi policy. These photos of Jewish life in Palestine, along with a lengthy text, appeared in 1934 in the Berlin paper Der Angriff. A Nazi Visits Palestine was the title of the multi-part series. A medal was struck by Goebbels in commemoration. On one side, the swastika.
Well, pardon me, boys and girls, I had to stop that because I had a defective recording. I'm going to edit in what I really wanted you to hear. So, stand by.
Your broadcast of Jewish law
is the grand Nazi scheme. There's only one political party in the world today, and that's called the Nazis. And you say, well, Adolf Hitler died in 1945, and that was the end of the Nazi party. But that's because you've never been told what the origin of Nazi is. NA is National Socialism, which was the German Nazis. And in 1923, there was a double agent who came to Hitler, and he said to Hitler, look, your Nazi party is not, your National Socialist Party is not getting off the ground. You need an alliance. And he suggested that they ally with the Zionist Party. So the NA of National Socialism joined with the Zionist Party in the World Zionist Party in 1923, and ever after was known as the Nazis, NAZI. The ZI was for Zionists, but of course no one knew that, because our popular mythology is that the terrible Nazis were attacking the Jews. But what we were never told is there was a great schism in the Jewish community of the world between the Zionists and the non-Zionists. You see, the non-Zionists were the Orthodox Jews who believed you could not have a Jewish state until the Jewish Messiah came. They didn't acknowledge Christ as Messiah, so they were waiting for their own Jewish Messiah to come. Then you would have a Jewish state, and that Jewish state would rule the world. But the Rothschilds in 1828 decided they couldn't wait for the Jewish Messiah, so they started what they called Reform Judaism under Moses Hess. And Reform Judaism said, yes, you can have a Jewish state before the Messiah comes. And the reason you could have it was the Rothschilds had made so much money, they said, we'll buy our own state. So the Rothschilds sent people out to the Middle East to have Jewish settlements, and which is today the state of Israel, totally created by the Rothschild money. And so Reform Judaism then became the cause of a great schism between Orthodox Jews and Reform Jews. Now, no one has ever told you this, I'm sure, but you think that the Jewish community is monolithic. In fact, it's split sharply down the middle. But even today, they have riots in the Jewish parliament between the Orthodox Jews and the Reform Jews. And they cannot agree on anything because the basic premise is a fundamental disagreement over whether a Jewish state should even exist today. So In Germany, in 1923, the German Jews were quite prosperous and quite happy, and they were not interested in becoming Zionists, and they were not interested in going to Palestine. After all, they had beautiful mansions in Germany, they had symphony orchestras, they had art, they had everything, and they were accepted in the community. As Ezra Pound said, Germany was the least anti-Jewish country in Europe. When you went over to Poland and Russia, you had very strong feeling against Jews. But in Germany, they were accepted and happy, so why would you ever have an anti-Jewish government in Germany? And, of course, Hitler, allying himself with the Zionists, he said, after all, you're right. He said, we have the same goals. And so he allied with the Zionist party, and the mission of the Nazis was to force the anti-Zionist Jews to accept Zionism. And this is what the concentration camps were about. They put the anti-Zionist Jews in the concentration camps, and they were placed under the direct administration of the Sonderkommandos, who were the Zionist Jews. So the concentration camps were run by the Zionist Jews in order to punish and get rid of the anti-Zionist Jews, which they did. And, of course, that's a part of the Holocaust that you were never told, but this was a fundamental Jewish disagreement, which the German people, Daniel Goldhagen wrote a book in which he said all Germans cooperated in their anti-Jewish feeling and the Holocaust, which was not true at all. The Germans did not even know what was going on, most of them. It's just like in the United States, when we were perfecting the atomic bomb and bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the American people knew nothing about it. It was forbidden to mention the atomic bomb. I was serving in the Air Force at that time. We never heard of any atomic mission or atomic bomb until the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. So you could say the American people are guilty of the greatest atrocity, the dropping of the atomic bomb on Japanese civilians. But that isn't true. The American people knew nothing about it. I knew nothing about it in the Air Force. And I was right there. So these things go on without the knowledge of the people or the approval of the people. But, of course, they have to accept the results. These things happen, and we're stuck with it. So this is the real story of Zionism, that the Nazis... So then, well, if the Nazis had allied with Zionists, why didn't the Nazi Party survive? Well, what happened was, in 1945, after the German military was defeated, they brought in the German leaders, the German generals, at the Nuremberg trials, tried and convicted and executed them. They had to execute them because they didn't want them around to testify that the... about the alliance between the Nazis and the Zionists. So they had to die, and they were executed for that reason. About all they told about the atrocities that the German generals had committed. But German generals are like any other generals. They don't really commit atrocities. The troops under their command may commit atrocities, but they don't commit any atrocities themselves. These German generals didn't go around shooting Jews or anybody else. But they were executed, and so the Zionist secret was safe. That and now the Zionists were now in command of the world because their National Socialist allies were now gone from history. And the Zionists had a free reign, so they set up the State of Israel. And in fact, some Jews themselves even claim that there should be a statue to Adolf Hitler in Israel, because he created the State of Israel, which is absolutely true. Without Adolf Hitler, Israel would not exist.